Welcome to Native America Calling. From Albuquerque, I'm Monica Brain. Black Lives Matter movement following George Floyd's death is putting new emphasis on Black and Indigenous solidarity. There are several notable examples of Black and Indigenous collaboration in the past, but there's also been divisions. In this hour, we'll hear some of the history and explore ideas for common ground moving forward. We're back right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Interior Department Friday signed an order that will start the transfer of the National Bison Range to the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton has more.
The transfer of the National Bison Range, which was carved out of the Flathead Indian Reservation in 1908, comes as part of the Montana Water Rights Protection Act. The federal legislation passed on the coattails of a federal spending bill in December and settles the CSKT's water rights. Interior Secretary David Bernhardt signed an order directing the Bureau of Land Management, Bureau of Indian Affairs, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to facilitate the transfer of the range to the tribes over the next 2 years. The range will be placed in trust for the tribes, and that trust status will be published in the Federal Register later this month. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
The Anchorage, Alaska Assembly unanimously approved an ordinance last week to formally establish a government-to-government relationship with the Native village of Aklutna. KNBA's Trip Krause reports on the details of the ordinance and the impact it could have.
The president of the village tribal council, Aaron Leggett, called the ordinance, quote, a monumental achievement by both governments.
This isn't something I think that's going to happen overnight. I think it will be a continually developing relationship. And I'm sure that we will find ways to simply have more dialogue.
The ordinance is the culmination of nearly a year of work between Leggett, a council working group of Forrest Dunbar, Cameron Perez-Verdia, and Christopher Constant, and others. Constant urged his fellow members to pass the ordinance.
The recognition of the sovereignty of the Native people of the village of Aklutna by the municipality of Anchorage is long overdue. And we are doing great work here.
In addition to recognizing the tribe's sovereignty, the ordinance also called for regular meetings between the two governments, and it calls for creating a written policy that promotes communication and clear and lasting relations, among other things. Aklutna is the only federally recognized tribe within the municipality of Anchorage. Leggett told the council that the Native village of Aklutna has a meeting later this month to take up a similar resolution to the Anchorage ordinance.
That was Trip Krause reporting. The director of the Indian Health Service is stepping down. In a letter last week to tribes and urban Indian organizations, Rear Admiral Michael Wiyaki announced his departure due to the incoming presidential administration to appoint new leadership. Wiyaki says he was asked to resign effective January 20th. He served as principal deputy director of the IHS from June 2017 to April 2020. Before being confirmed as director, the Indian Health Service provides care to more than 2 million American Indian and Alaska Native people across the country. Wiyaki recently reflected on the IHS in 2020 and challenges during the pandemic while highlighting some accomplishments, including installing water stations on the Navajo Nation, conducting more than 1 million COVID-19 tests, and the creation of a critical care response team. The IHS is currently working on its COVID-19 vaccination plan. As of early January, the agency had distributed more than 175,000 COVID-19 vaccines to Indian country. Wiyaki in the letter says he was honored to serve and believes the IHS is more capable now than ever before of fulfilling quality healthcare systems. The Presidential Inaugural Committee is gearing up for President-elect Joe Biden to take office on Wednesday. The committee hosted a virtual welcome event Saturday, which highlighted the country's diversity. The event included an Indigenous land acknowledgement by Representative Deb Holland and singers from the Fort Yuma Kutsan tribe. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
If you're a Native American expanding or starting a business, the Indian Loan Guarantee and Insurance Program supports your lender so your lender can make the business loan you need. Info by emailing dci@bia.gov. The Office of Indian Energy and Economic Development supports this program.
Support by the Association of American Indian Physicians and the SAMHSA-sponsored Opioid Response Network, working across the nation to address the opioid crisis in tribal communities. Information and support at aaip.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain, joining you through Skype. African Americans and Native Americans both confront ongoing, overt, and subtle forms of racism, but they don't always present as a united front in their efforts to end it. Following the death of George Floyd, Indigenous voices were among those amplified, speaking out against racial inequality. Many activists and community leaders want to keep that going. You're welcome to join our conversation today. What do Black and Natives have in common? And what are the hurdles? Is solidarity among racial communities important to you? Give us a call. You can join the conversation by dialing 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now from Bulbancha in Louisiana is Dr. Jeffrey Derensburg. He's a writer, artist, and culture bearer, and he's an enrolled member and a tribal leader of the Attack Apa Ishak Nation. Welcome to Native America Calling, Jeffrey.
Well, Yotol, I'm really happy to speak with y'all. I'm Hinke Epshok, Jeffrey Derensburg, Takapal Ishak Yukitiki, We Shiwat Yukiti, Yabulbancha, Keto Kushmel, Pistox Ush. I'm Jeffrey Derensburg of the Alligator Band of the Takapal Ishak Nation, and I live here in Bulbancha, which is the name colonists attempted to rename as New Orleans, though it didn't quite sink in with some of us. And I say Kushmel Pistox Ush, Black Lives Matter. Happy to be speaking with you today. I think my second time on Native America Calling.
Yeah, we're happy to have you back, Jeffrey. We really appreciate you spending your Martin Luther King Day with us on the airwaves. And, you know, thinking of this federal holiday, what are you thinking about in this time that we're facing incredible situation with what's going on, what happened at the Capitol, what's happening across the United States? What are your thoughts?
I think one of the things I am thinking about is how much, talking about what happened at the Capitol, how much forces against democracy, forces that support the oppression of African-American people, who support the oppression of indigenous populations, are often very well united, working together. And on the other side, we are often not as united. Dr. King is very forthright. He spoke, as many Native people know, several times about indigenous issues, very much said that the United States was founded in genocide and that the original racism here was against the indigenous population. Dr. King really embraced all forms of oppression of people in terms of economics, in terms of ethnicity. He spoke to all of that. And it's important for us to realize that he recognized that our oppression is connected. All the ways we are oppressed are connected. And he really wanted people to work together, to march together into a better future. And that's something we should all remember. And we should not water down his radical vision of people being free from multiple types of oppression. And I think that is something that we must remember today. And I think, of course, there's also Dr. King's influence on other civil rights movements. Just the fact that he did not face an easy road. It wasn't just peaceful marches. It was, facing violence. He was assassinated, but he just kept going. It's such an inspiration to any person who is truly oppressed and seeks liberation, that there is a path forward. There's someone who is willing to show that way forward, and that cannot be forgotten.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. You know, I'm thinking about your homeland where you are right now, and the relationship between African Americans and Indigenous people. And I know that that has a long, long history. What would you like to share about that?
Well, Louisiana is kind of an unusual place here. Most of our Indigenous nations are not fairly recognized, including my own. The United States has published all or part of 3 books about us. And, we are definitely one of the important historic tribes of Louisiana, the Tacoma Ishak. But one of the things that's also kind of unique about our Indigenous nations here is how many of us have strong African-American presence within our tribes. And that goes back to the time in which Indigenous people and African people in Louisiana were enslaved together. They were enslaved together in this very city where I sit, Bulbancha, which people usually call New Orleans. Also, after the Civil War, there was often a reclassification of peoples here such that many people who are members of Indigenous nations appear as mulatto or Negro on records. At some point when the Louisiana Purchase happened, there were many Indigenous enslaved people in the United States, didn't really like Louisiana having, chattel slavery of Indigenous people. And there were some court rulings that eventually led to the ability of slave owners to reclassify people's ethnicities so as to maintain them in slavery. And this has caused, Louisiana's native identity to be heavily interspersed with African Americans oftentimes. It also has caused, people of Louisiana who are African American to often have, Indigenous relatives in the not too distant cultural memory, often preserve Indigenous culture, customs. And then we have, a very large triplicate mixed European African Indigenous population, the Louisiana Creole population, of which I am part of. And growing up, I had older relatives who spoke Indigenous languages. I've sort of done my own. I now do work in Indigenous languages as well. And our cultures are heavily mixed, and many of the foods here, musical, cultural things in Louisiana, Louisiana is really famous for, are mixtures of African and Indigenous culture. When we think of our classic dishes like gumbo, red beans and rice, our crawfish boils and things, those are very often just Indigenous or combinations of Indigenous ingredients and African techniques. So I think it's very important, in Louisiana for people to recognize that, the Indigenous parts of Louisiana are real and they're such a real contribution, but also the African contributions to Indigenous culture here don't, just because someone is Black, that doesn't make them less Native, and because they're Native, it doesn't make them less African-American. And that's something I often encourage people to understand about us, and especially about our large mixed populations.
Yeah, that's really fascinating, Jeffrey, that you mentioned that the attempts for slave owners to reclassify people because they were Indigenous, and there was not wanting Indigenous people, to be enslaved. Does that go back to the Constitution and speaking to Indigenous about Native people in the Constitution?
Well, here there's the Louisiana is much older than the United States, and much of its culture is much older than the United States. I'm not talking the way that Indigenous cultures are older than the United States, but the city where I sit now has a continuous cultural development. Many influential things have started happening here from its colonial founding in the early 1700s before the United States existed. The United States, of course, has its own, Indian savages, thing in the Declaration of Independence. But here, there were often attempts to try to classify Native people. One prominent, colonial figure here, Julian Poydras, actually said that, if Indigenous people here were to be liberated from slavery, that might cause problems because African Americans will want the same thing, et cetera. I mentioned this information from a wonderful researcher who's from here, an Apache Cherokee researcher, Layla Blackbird, who's currently working on her PhD at University of Chicago. And I think that that's important that they realize that if one of these groups of people gets the taste of freedom, the others will as well. And, that's an important thing to notice on Martin Luther King Day, that the quest for, liberation of African Americans eventually spilled over to a quest for economic liberation and spilled, you know, was influential on things like the American Indian Movement, was influential on the gay rights movement. It was the idea of like, oh, wait, there's freedom. Even you can actually achieve freedom, then there's some work that we have to do. And this is an amazingly influential and powerful warrior in that work, you know, is Martin Luther King.
Mm, absolutely. Well, today we're celebrating Martin Luther King Day, and we're talking about Black and Indigenous solidarity. And if you want to weigh in on this, if you want to share, we'd love to hear from you. Phone lines are open. The number to join us is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. We're talking with Dr. Jeffrey Dernsberg. He's a writer, artist, culture bearer, and he is a tribal leader from the Attakapa Ishuk Nation in Louisiana. And we're just about to go to the break, Jeffrey, but I want to give you a moment, just anything else you'd like to share about the importance of knowing this history.
It really helps people to understand things about themselves. It helped me to understand why, you know, for example, when I go to someone's res, they often think I'm a member of the tribe, but my birth certificate lists both of my very light-skinned parents, who definitely didn't always pass for white, but definitely, you know, listed them both as Negro, and it helped me to understand that. And just finding other people who are interested in researching these topics in Louisiana, and some of the more prominent ones besides Layla Blackbird would be Andrew Jolivet of UC San Diego, who's a tribal council member. I mean, a tribal cousin of mine, or Rain Prudhomme Cranford, or Carolyn Dunn, that there were experiences we had that needed an explanation, and experiences for how we were treated, how we were classified, how our relatives appear in records, that needed an explanation. And history in that respect for any oppressed peoples can be very liberating, because you can see where you came from and what forces were at play in your oppression. And I think that's extremely important.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to dig way more into this after the break. We've got two more guests joining us as well. And we want to hear your voice too. What are you thinking about on this Martin Luther King Day? What are you thinking about in terms of the Black Lives Matter movement and how it connects with the American Indian movement, with Indigenous solidarity? Everyone is welcome to the table today. I really want to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. We're live here today on Native America Calling, and we're bringing you a conversation about Black Lives Matter, because they do. And we want to know what you think about how it connects with Indigenous people. We're going to go to a short break. We'll be right back. Politicians, scholars, and regular citizens worry that America's democracy is at a crossroads. The Haudenosaunee Confederacy's Great Law of Peace offered guidance during the birth of America's democracy. Can Native ideals bring healing during the current crisis? We'll hear about the Native influence on U.S. democracy on the next Native America Calling.
Support by Roswell Park, who know tribal communities face persistent challenges in health equity, such as cancer and higher death rates. The Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center is dedicated to advancing cancer research that will lead to translatable science, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous populations worldwide. Are you at high risk for cancer? A no-charge online assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain, sitting in for Tara Gatewood today. We're talking about Black and Indigenous solidarity today. What does that mean to you? And why do you think it's needed? Join our conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Before the break, we're talking with Dr. Jeffrey Dernsberg. He's a writer, artist, and culture bearer. I want to add some more voices to the conversation now. Joining us now from Los Angeles, California, is Azzy Dungji. She's a writer and producer and actor, and she's Pamunkey and African American. Welcome to Native America Calling, Azzy.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. Wingapo, that's hello, and Pamunkey. Kana, thank you for having me.
Yes, it's great to hear your voice. and all the way from Los Angeles. Also, joining us from Portland, Oregon is Amber Starks. She's Afro-Indigenous. She's Muscogee Creek and African-American. Welcome to Native America Calling, Amber.
Este, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here and really excited to be a part of the conversation with my friend AZ and Dr. Jeffrey. You are so on point. Thank you for those words. They're so brilliant.
All right. We love to start off the week with brilliant thoughts and brilliant ideas on Native America Calling. And if you want to be brilliant, give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. Izzy, let's start with you. I want to give you the moment to share what I did for Jeffrey in terms of, like, you know, what are you thinking about today on this holiday?
Well, I just have to say that I'm really just filled with, I don't know, gratefulness. I'm thankful for this moment. I know that there's so much going on that's just horrific, but I do feel like there's also a burgeoning of people just being tired of people, not just Black and Native, but also white people, being tired of the systems that have been oppressing us for so long and are looking for a new way. And I feel like that's where Native and Black voices have really kind of pushed ourselves to the forefront and saying, like, yeah, we've been saying this forever, and we have alternatives, and we have ideas, and we have a vision for our future that's for all of us. And so I'm really grateful for this moment because it's been a long time coming.
Yeah. I agree too. What about you, Amber? What are you thinking about today?
Yeah, same. I feel super hopeful. You know, just listening to Dr. Jeffrey, I was just thinking about, you know, the ways in which Black folks and Native peoples have been doing this work for a very long time. You know, I like to speak to the idea that Black folks have been abolitionists before abolition was, like, you know, a catchphrase, and Native folks have been saying land back since the first piece of land has been stolen. And so I feel like today kind of represents the culmination of, like, you know, our individual communities and nations doing that work, but also the collaborative work that we've been doing, because I think we have realized, you know, from the beginning that we have a common oppressor and that this settler colonial project is a myth, in that it, you know, this is still indigenous land. Black folks are not the property of the settler state, of this nation. And so I feel like, you know, the George Floyd murder, us being in quarantine has really forced us to look at ourselves, like, for real, right? We're not distracted by, you know, working necessarily. Definitely, I want to shout out, you know, essential workers who have still had to work during this time. But I definitely feel like, as AZ said, Black and Indigenous folks who have been speaking these things for a long time have kind of been pushed to the forefront. And I feel like finally there's some real movement. You know, there's some authentic movement. I think people are starting to believe us, you know, when we say, like, we are being murdered. People are starting to believe Indigenous people when we say, this is our land, and you are still continuously erasing us. And so I feel empowered. I feel, you know, more dedicated to speaking out against, and even, you know, even a little bit more brave. There's definitely times where, like, I fear, you know, some of the things that I say because I don't know, you know, if people are there yet. But I think this is the to kind of push people outside their comfort zones and to have these difficult conversations. And that's, you know, in between, you know, communities, the Black and Native community, that's, you know, in between, you know, Black and Native communities and white folks, right? We're having these really uncomfortable conversations, but this is an uncomfortable time. And I kind of feel like we should use this momentum to, like, realize an actual, like, authentic Indigenous future and an actualized Black liberated future. So I'm feeling a little bit more brave, and I, you know, I'm thankful for, you know, the work of our predecessors and our ancestors who did this work when it wasn't popular, when there wasn't social media.
Yeah, Amber, I really hear that. I hear what you're saying. But I also really like
what you said about having to be a little uncomfortable too. And so I'm going to ask some uncomfortable questions, you know, to really get the conversation going here. And you talk about these Black and Indigenous people have been fighting for the same things, but has it always been, you know, parallel towards going towards the same thing side by side with each other? Because I can point back to times in history. I mean, when we see the tribes, some tribes in Oklahoma actually owning slaves, Black slaves, or just today, anti-Black racism in Native communities that is still prevalent in some places. And so, you know, I wonder if you can unpack that and share a little bit about how they haven't always been parallel.
Absolutely. And I'm no historian, but, you know, being a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation, you know, I understand a lot of our tribes in the Southeast did have that complex history of, like, participating in chattel slavery. And what I want to say is that we don't have to ignore those instances of lateral violence to also recognize that Black and Native folks have worked together, have always worked together. But I also think that we have to contextualize it and understand that the settler state did everything it could to make sure that we saw one another as the actual oppressor, right? Weaponizing lateral violence as a means of us seeing one another as the reason why we aren't free, right? And this is not to ignore the real harm that we've caused one another in our attempts for our own liberation, our own community's liberation. And I also think we see that today still. We see examples where Black folks are, you know, ostracized or disenrolled from tribal communities because of the anti-Blackness that we've all learned, right? We've all learned white supremacy. We've all learned settler colonialism. We've all learned that Native people are invisible and shouldn't be seen, right? And so I think that we don't have to ignore those instances of violence to also recognize that we have been fighting. And, you know, our struggles have been parallel. They have overlapped in some cases. And at the same time, there has been real violence, and there still is real violence. And so I don't want to create, like, you know, I don't want to perpetuate an idea that we've always been just, you know, free from, like, hurting one another and harming one another, because that isn't the truth. And we know that today that still is a situation. But what I do hope that we understand is that our liberation, our, you know, quest for freedom is linked, and that we do have a mutual oppressor. We've always had one. And that oppressor's intent has always been for us to see one another as an obstacle to our freedom, right? Seeing one another as the means for our oppression. Even in the instances of the Buffalo Soldiers, you know, these were freed, you know, enslaved persons who were, you know, fought in the Civil War. And then the federal government sent them out west to remove, you know, Native folks off their land. And if you think about that, think about how the settler state used them as a means of, like, that was Native, those Native populations' first encounter with the settler state. So they didn't see white people for the first time. They saw Black folks. But we have to think about how intentional the settler state has used our communities, you know, in that old, like, you know, divide and conquer type thing, right? And so though those things are real, though those instances are real, I think if we don't contextualize them, even today, if we don't contextualize them, then we'll miss how integral our freedom and our liberation are to, like, an authentic Indigenous future, an authentic liberated Black future. So,
Amber, sorry to interrupt you, but I really want to throw that to AZ about this attempt to contextualize these two stories and these two situations with the two groups of people. AZ, do you find that hard to do? Particularly, you know, you work in Hollywood, and I imagine, you know, Hollywood rarely gets it right. So do you find it hard to sort of contextualize that story and the complexity of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest issues we have is that our education has been, you know, created by white supremacy. So like Amber was saying about the Buffalo Soldiers, in that being the first time that, you know, Native people in that area met the settler state, and it was, you know, through these Black men, there's still situations where we aren't seeing each other except through the eyes of the settler state. So we, you know, in media, there are places in Native country where their idea of who Black people are is from what the media has kind of portrayed. And there are places, of course, with Black people where their only understanding of indigeneity comes from this myth that actually Dr. King talked about, that the genocide of Indigenous people had been turned into a myth in the American consciousness, that the white violence against our tribal nations was exalted in literature, in drama, in folklore, in films. And it's corrupted us with a deep-seated sense of prejudice. And King wrote about that because it's not just something that affects white people and the way white people respond to Native people, but it's also affected the way Black people understand Native nations. And so there's a lot of tension and contentiousness between the two groups just because we don't know enough about each other and about our histories. A lot of Black people only know, you know, that Native people were either genocided or they owned slaves. You know, they mm-hmm. kind of have this or mascots. On the other side. You know, yeah. So it is really something that has kept us apart. But like Amber said, it's been very intentional because any time that we have come together, we have been a significant threat to white supremacy.
Yeah. That's the thing that I feel like we're at the dawn of right now. And it has some people like our guest today really excited, and other folks are afraid, you know. And let's go to the phone lines. I really want to hear what our listeners are thinking about this. You know, are you excited about the possibility of Black and Indigenous people coming together, being a force to be reckoned with against white supremacy? What do you think about that? Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. Let's go to Melvin in Santee, Nebraska, tuned in on KZYK. Hey there, Melvin. Thanks for tuning in. What are you thinking about?
Well, good morning. Many of our Black allies who supported Native causes, you know, like Jesse Jackson and that Red Basket program, when we walked to Washington in 78 for that freedom of religion, which Carter signed, Black churches and Black groups really supported us well and helped us get there. The other thing is, historically, in 1799 in Florida, in 1899 and 1999 in Oklahoma, there was always these cases that were going to the Supreme Court about who is a Black Indian trying to take their rights away and all that. And I always thought, geez, this is the third time a case went before the Supreme Court on recognizing Black Indians. We've never done that to white Indians. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting. And we could spend several hours on those cases and the struggles or the issues with the freedmen, for example, in the Cherokee Nation. Melvin, it's always great to hear from you. Thank you so much for giving us a call. Let's go to Tomas in Santa Fe, tuned in on KUNM. Hey there, Tomas, what are you thinking?
Hello, thank you for having me. Happy Martin Luther King's Day. And yeah, the question is, what do you think of Black Lives Matter? What is going on in your mind today? So I'd like to report that in a lot of the white community, it's like it's kind of a failure because of organizing. And so I'm familiar with the Hawaiians on the Big Island with the protests and occupation of the access road leading up to the summit of Mauna Kea. and how they did it with protocols, the ancient ways, a lot of dignity and grace, where a lot of young people organizing how to occupy and make change and such. So really look at the Hawaiians, because they're leading the way.
Hmm. Hawaiians leading the way, Native Hawaiians, Kanaka Maoli leading the way in showing resistance to, you know, they're fighting a telescope. I don't know, it's like the 17th, 18th telescope that they're trying to put on their sacred mountain. And, you know, connecting that to Martin Luther King today. So interesting. I want to hear more. Give us a call. We want to hear from you. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. We've got a great lineup today. Dr. Jeffrey Derensburg. He's a writer, artist, culture bearer, and he is from the Atakapa Ishuk Nation, Shock Nation. Also, Amber Starks. She's Afro-Indigenous. She's Muscogee Creek and African-American. And AZ Dungy. She is a writer, producer, and actor. She's Pamunkey and African-American. If you want to talk to any of them, if you want to call and tell us what you're thinking about on Martin Luther King Day, give us a call. Phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. What are you thinking about with the Black Lives Matter movement? What do you think about the Black Lives Matter movement? And how do you connect it to the American Indian movement, to the Red Power movement? This is your time to weigh in, tell us some history. Elders, you're invited to the conversation. 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. We're going to go to a short break. We'll be right back.
Support by the Association of American Indian Physicians and the SAMHSA-sponsored Opioid Response Network, working with tribal communities across the nation to address the opioid crisis. Breaking the cycle starts with preventing opioid misuse, treating opioid use disorder with medications and counseling, and recovery support during all phases of recovery. If you or a loved one is challenged by opioid use disorder, you can find additional information at aaip.org.
Thank you for tuning in to Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain, joining you today through Skype. We're talking about Black and Indigenous solidarity, and there's still time to join a conversation. How has Black Lives Matter movement prompted you to think differently about partnerships between Native Americans and other racial groups? The number to join is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's go back to the phone lines. We've got Julius in Jacksonville, Florida, tuned in online. Hey there, Julius. What are you thinking about?
Hello. Basically, I want to say it is possible that Black and Native unity, it's very possible, because look back at the 1830s. You had the Seminoles and the Black freedmen. They joined forces to fight against the U.S. government, and they beat them. Many people don't know this, but Osceola had a Black wife. Most people don't know that. I could even go back to the 1970s. A lot of the Black Panthers were friends with Russell Means. And back in the 1980s, Russell Means wouldn't just go to the reservations, but he would speak to the Black colleges as well. So it's possible. It is very much possible. And even in my own family, we're both Black and Indigenous. So it's very much possible. That's just the way I feel about it.
Yeah, thank you, Julius. It's nice to hear from the East Coast. We don't get a lot of calls from the East Coast in Jacksonville, Florida, tuned in online. Let's go to Gordon in Red Lake, Minnesota, tuned in on KOJB. Hey there, Gordon.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I just wanted to say that in the mid-60s, when we were first trying to raise money to start an Indian center in Minneapolis, the Urban Coalition, which is mostly a Black-funded organization, gave us money to start our first Indian center. They helped us a lot. They helped us move in. We lived in a project in North Minneapolis. And I went down to South Minneapolis, and when we went around to get money for funding to start an Indian center, We got the money from the Chamber of Commerce, the Moore Board, and the Urban Coalition. They gave us enough money to secure the building and get our stuff to get in there and start opening up the Indian Center. And that was where the American Indian Movement started, and the Black Panthers even came there and looked at our business. So, I mean, it was so cool that they helped us. They didn't have to. You know, I was a little boy then. I was about 15 years old, and we went around with handwritten spiral notebook torn out of the notebook papers. That was our proposal.
I love it, Gordon. It's so great to hear this history, this living history of Red Power Movement, of in solidarity with the African American movement. Jeffrey, what are you thinking about with all our callers and their history? And you know, is it making you even more hopeful?
It does, and this is just some wonderful information. I didn't know, and I just love hearing that. I was really interested in something a caller, I think Melvin, said a while back. He said that, you know, no one really tries to disenfranchise white Indians to do it often for black Indians. And one thing I do like, my favorite powwow to go to in Louisiana, no offense to any others, is the powwow the Tunica Biloxi tribe has here in Marksville. And you will often see people who are enrolled members of that federally recognized tribe who look African-American, who are dancing in regalia. And sometimes people come from, you know, outside of Louisiana, that powwow, and they think that's strange. And I often tell them, like, well, would you think it was strange if someone were white passing and they had on regalia? You could see that at pretty much any powwow in the United States. And no one really bats an eye. Like, why should it be different if the person is black passing or if they look what you consider African-American? They still have the same ancestry to be enrolled in the tribe, you know, and that indicates, you know, some, like, you know, oftentimes it's possible to absorb some of the settler colonial attitudes towards African-Americans, but that history of solidarity is much stronger than the one of difference. And I'm sure that the examples your colleagues have given are just wonderful, and I'm sure we could go on for many, many days telling these stories of solidarity and support and mutual quest for liberation. And I think that gives me a lot of hope right now.
Yeah, Jeffrey, we haven't even touched on colorism and how that affects African-American communities, Black communities, and Indigenous communities so differently and then also in such parallel ways. AZ, what are you thinking about as we are, you know, sort of unfolding this conversation about solidarity?
Well, since you brought up colorism, I mean, I think that that's a really important aspect of this conversation, because, you know, it has a real historic basis. I can just say, like, in Virginia, which is where my tribe is from, which I consider kind of like the birthplace of the racial caste system, because that's where, you know, all these other laws around the country kind of were patterned after racial laws in Virginia. And what happened in the first of all, blacks and black people and Native American people had been intermixing because they had been dealing with white oppression since 1619, which for tribes in the West sounds really crazy, but we were dealing with you know, white settlers since 1619. And so there was a lot of solidarity in our communities. My tribe, the Pamunkey, were known for harboring runaway slaves and things like that. And so at a point, white settlers in Virginia realized that they could use that against tribes, that they could actually take away tribal sovereignty by accusing a tribe of becoming of having too much black ancestry. It didn't work the other way around. In fact, mixing with white people was encouraged because it furthered assimilation. But when it came to mixing with black people, that was a threat. And what I've recently realized is the biggest threat in that was that on Native land, Native people could have guns, but free black people or free people of color, which also included Native people that were off reservation, it was illegal for them to have guns because they weren't considered citizens of the United States. So so any time you had the mixing, you had more people that could have guns. And the white colonial or the white settler powers were very afraid of more uprisings like the Seminole. And so what they did was, you know, they made these kind of laws where if a tribe was too black or considered too black by their neighbors, really, they were disbanded and their land was taken. And then they were reassigned mulatto or Negro, and their rights to bear arms were taken as well. And so what happened in the tribe, including my own, was the tribes had to kind of protect themselves by enacting Jim Crow-like laws within their tribal system. So you couldn't marry a black person. You couldn't associate with a black person. They even purged reservations of people that were too dark. So the colorism came to play where now there are people in my tribe that are blonde and blue-eyed, but I personally, you know, my family was completely disenfranchised because of this, and we're still fighting for enrollment because of this. And we're also fighting against, you know, just colorism in our communities. And I think, again, we have to remember that it all goes back to, you know, who is benefiting. And in the end, you know, whenever there are these laws or these ways of seeing each other that are based in color and race, that benefits the racial caste system that benefits white supremacy. So, you know, it's important that when we talk about solidarity, we're also talking about uprooting these systems that were kind of forced on us that aren't from our kinship. They're not from our understanding of kinship ties and our understanding of community. You know, these are a direct result of white supremacy. So that, you know, that comes up for me every time we have these discussions. But I'm also very excited because I feel like this is the first time in my life that my identity has been seen. The first person we think of in the American Revolution, who is Crispus Attucks, he was black and native. But people don't even talk about that because, you know, that just isn't an identity in our mind. But he was Wampanoag and black and had been born a slave. So we've been here from the beginning, and I'm really excited about, you know, the fact that, you know, we're having discussions where we're included, because I feel like our taking up space between these two communities is really important.
Yeah. And I just think this is just the beginning of those. I mean, of course they have been going on, but like, it's not one of those things where you can just have an hour long conversation on Martin Luther King Day and then we're good to go. You know, we have to have these conversations about colorism. We have to have these conversations about solidarity movements, and they have to be ongoing. Amber, are you working on continuing those kinds of conversations, and how do you go about it?
I absolutely am every day, all day, it seems like. I feel like a lot of the things that I speak to are all grounded in this conversation. And, you know, one of the callers made a point about the organization of the Black Lives Matter movement. And I really want to point out that the Black Lives Matter movement is just a continuation of the Black Liberation Movement, and that there have been many successes of the Black Liberation Movement, including like our partnerships with the Red Power Movement. And so I don't want us to compare the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, the current day to like what, you know, or I don't want us to perceive it as something that isn't working, because it absolutely is. And we can see that in a lot of ways, just in our time, just thinking about how, you know, NFL teams are addressing their racist names, right? We're looking at real instances where the Black Lives Matter movement is pushing us forward. And I feel like this is why these conversations are important, because we are learning, you know, Black Lives Matter is just, you know, they're a terrorist organization, they're, you know, this, they're that. But again, that's through the eyes of the settler state and how they perpetuate the narrative around Black liberation movements. So I think it's really important to have conversations within the community so we can talk about ways in which our movements are actually successful. And so, yeah, I think, you know, speaking also to what AZ said about how Black natives
you know, colorism and how we're often, you know, Black Natives are often not seen or not heard. I think that there's almost this extra requirement of those of us who are Black and Native to kind of prove ourselves. You know, we say these are our communities. We could be from our communities, you know, off the res, you know, and speaking the language, knowing the culture, and still be held to like a higher standard. Again, that's because, you know, the settler state, you know, uses these as tools of genocide, right? To like have us question our authenticity and have us, you know, having to prove that Native people still exist, and especially in Black bodies, right? So I think as a community in Indian country, I think in the Black community, we have to hold ourselves accountable of how we see one another, because in a lot of ways, we're trying to hold the settler state accountable, but we don't hold ourselves accountable for the ways in which we perpetuate the settler state in our own communities. So absolutely.
Yeah. So give us an example of that, Amber. Give us an example of how we perpetuate that.
This colorism is a great example. Disenrolling freedmen is a great example. Asking Black Natives to prove themselves. I recently had someone, you know, get online and just slander me and say I'm not even enrolled, while I'm sitting there with my enrollment, you know, my citizenship card in my pocket, right? It's like this whole idea that Black folks cannot be Native, right? That our indigeneity is, that our Blackness mutes our indigeneity, or, you know, defiles our indigeneity. And so I think that the freedmen example within the five tribes is an excellent example of how we need to hold ourselves accountable. You know, the ways in which we treat our relatives, like AZ said, are not our traditional ways of understanding kinship. And I think that if we want to go forward and have an actualized, liberated, you know, authentic, sovereign, indigenous future, we have to deal with our own ways of how we're oppressing our relatives, right? How we're disenrolling our relatives simply because they also happen to be Black. You know, there are countless things that we can discuss. So like you said, there's an hour. And so I think many of us are having these conversations online. We're speaking to this because we want the truth. We want to speak to the truth, and we actually want to move ourselves forward and not perpetuate, you know, our own oppression, not perpetuate a system that's meant to genocide us, right? To remove us off our lands, and to claim ownership of the lands that, you know, that we have a right to steward.
Well, we're just at the end of the hour, and like I said, we could go on for quite some time about this. Jeffrey, I want to give you an opportunity. What do you think is the number one thing that we need to do in terms of solidarity between Black and Indigenous movements?
I think we have to cultivate an attitude of listening and respect. You know, we have to learn to try to understand other people's experiences, learn where they're coming from, appreciate that they have their own struggles in this quest for liberation that we might not, appreciate that our struggles are nevertheless heavily interrelated, and that we need to show up for each other. African-American people and Native people need to show up for each other, and also realize that we've been showing up for each other for a long time, and we are part of each other. We are not entirely separate peoples. And I think that's a very crucial thing. It's not those people over there. It's us people here right now together, where we've been for a very long time here in Turtle Island. And that's one of the things I think people should cultivate first, that sort of attitude of solidarity.
Well, I really appreciate it, Dr. Jeffrey Derensberg. He's a writer, artist, and culture bearer, and a member of the Attack Ipashok Nation in Louisiana. And we also, thanks so much to Amber Stark. She is Muscogee Creek and African American and identifies as Afro-Indigenous. And Azzy Dungji, thank you so much for joining us. She's a writer, producer, and actor, and you might see her on TV coming up soon, so take a look. And she is Pamunkey and African American. We're going to be back tomorrow with another history conversation about democracy and whether or not our democracy is in crisis, and the Indigenous connection to the birth of democracy in the United States. I'm Monica Brain. Have a good one.
Support by Utah Dene Bekea, working to fully restore Bears Ears National Monument by asking the Biden administration to fulfill the original vision of protection for 1.9 million acres with meaningful co-management by tribes. It's time we respect ancestral lands and our collective American heritage by listening to and learning from tribes on stewardships of these cultural landscapes. Info on supporting this effort at utahdene.org. That's UTAHDINE.org.
Tahis nitsetan tihiele nytan hetega itse ytetia sati sai. Noitsi kaskoli, taneltoti, tohi tetehti alle osta tsejelti hiele nytan hetega i. Tatlanoheta nieuja ojele nytan hetega anaksestiski naski jiget stela at healthcare.gov alle 1-800-318-2596. He aget anosa Medicare alle Medicaid unadalka i.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.